loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss the role played by Ukrainian neo-Nazi militias in the growth of white supremacist groups in the United States. We'll have an in-depth conversation with journalist and author Max Blumenthal. And then it's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, California's wildfires continued to burn out of control over the weekend, with 77 people dead and at least 997 still missing. President Trump visited Paradise, California, the town that was completely devastated, and called it Pleasure, California. He also claimed that the president of Finland told him that raking the forest floor would prevent future fires. Next, Democrats in the Georgia and Florida governor's races and the Florida Senate race conceded to their Republican challengers over the weekend amid charges of voter suppression. Meanwhile, all seven of Orange County, California's House races went to Democrats for the first time ever. Then, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum, or APEC, ended in Papua New Guinea this weekend, and for the first time, no end-of-summit communique was issued. The U.S. and China exchanged repeated barbs over trade, and in the end, Papuan Prime Minister Peter O'Neill said, quote, "You all know who the two big giants in the room were, so what can I say?" unquote. And then, at its first meeting since the midterm elections, the House Progressive Caucus, which has increased its membership by 20 thanks to those elections, announced its policy priorities. They include healthcare, jobs, and fighting corruption. And although the caucus chairman said that abolishing Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was still on the table, it was pushed to secondary importance. And finally, today, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, Senators Richard Blumenthal, Sheldon Whitehouse, and Mazie Hirono filed suit today against President Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general. The lawsuit alleges that Trump is acting unlawfully by not allowing the Senate to weigh in on his pick. As Whitaker was a staff person in the department rather than a Senate-confirmed official, he has never been through a confirmation process. All three senators are members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Yemen's Houthi rebels, who are fighting the Saudi-led and U.S.-supported coalition in Yemen, said yesterday that they are ready for a ceasefire if Saudi Arabia, quote, wants peace, unquote. The Yemeni government announced a few hours later that it would take part in peace talks in Sweden. Nissan chairman Carlos Ghosn was arrested today in Japan for, quote, significant acts of misconduct, unquote, including personal use of company assets and severe underreporting of Ghosn's compensation. Following a whistleblower report, Nissan said that it had been investigating Ghosn for months, along with another executive. The Taliban and the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan ended 3 days of talks with no deal, the envoy announced today. The goal of the effort is to secure a peace agreement in Afghanistan by April 2019. The Taliban has not accepted April as a deadline, a date that coincides with Afghan presidential elections. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the connection between the white supremacist, white nationalist movement in the United States and neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine. Author and journalist Max Blumenthal writes, quote, "Last month, an unsealed FBI indictment of four American white supremacists from the Rise Above movement, RAM, declared that the defendants had trained with Ukraine's Azov Battalion, a neo-Nazi militia, officially incorporated into the country's National Guard. The training took place after the white supremacist gang participated in violent riots in Huntington Beach in Berkeley, California, and Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. We are joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist. He is a best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Great to be back.
This, Max, is an important story, a really, really important story. It was published by Mint Press News. You wrote it. I think I want to just suggest to every one of the people listening to this broadcast afterwards, after you hear this, go to the story itself and read the story and share it with your friends. The title, Max, is Blowback, an inside look at how U.S.-funded fascists in Ukraine mentor U.S. white supremacists. Go ahead.
Well, let me just talk about the two main protagonist groups in this really disturbing story. And I think, you know, most listeners here will be familiar with the fact that Ukraine is becoming overrun with neo-Nazism. But this is, you know, a new development because, as you mentioned at the top, there's an unsealed FBI indictment which finds that the Azov Battalion, which has been incorporated into the Ukrainian military officially as part of its National Guard to fight with pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine, is training and radicalizing United States-based white supremacy organizations. So you have the Azov Battalion, which has received weapons from the U.S. and has even received trainers from the officers from the U.S. Marines to coordinate logistics in the field with its own officer corps, a officially white supremacist wing of the Ukrainian military, founded by Andrei Beletsky, who is an open neo-Nazi, someone who has said that his goal is to lead a crusade against the Semite-led Untermensch in the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival. This is a U.S.-funded group, has been organizing a series of conferences. They have established a political party called the National Corps, and they have an international secretary who is a relatively young woman, philosophy major, kind of a in the hipster black metal scene in Kiev, sort of a Richard Spencer type character, you know, an alt-right figure named Olena Samanyaka. And she organizes all these conferences several times a year at a club in Kiev, which is an officially neo-Nazi club called the Reconquista Club. And the conferences are called the Pan-Europa. And the Pan-Europa refers to her goal and the goal of the Azov Battalion to lead a reconquest of Europe on behalf of the white race and to purge Europe of all the impure elements, homosexuals, Jews, migrants, Roma, etc. And they have been hosting figures from fascists from around the world, including the United States. And that's where the Rise Above movement comes in. The Rise Above movement is basically a white supremacist fight club in Southern California. These are like middle class, upper middle class kids in their 20s who think that, you know, being a white man makes them really persecuted. They're, you know, a big part of the alt-right, and they kind of position themselves as the guardian angels of the alt-right at rallies. And when they're confronted by anti-racist demonstrators, these characters display their MMA skills and basically beat the crap out of any anti-racist who's on the scene. For some reason, in 2017, when they put their violence on display, not only in Charlottesville, where we saw vehicular homicide against Heather Heyer by a neo-Nazi, but in Berkeley and in Huntington Beach, California, U.S. law enforcement did nothing. It was clear, though, that they were being watched. And when four of the Rise Above movement's leaders went on a trip to Europe, first to celebrate Hitler's birthday in Germany, and then to go to Ukraine, which is effectively the international base of fascism right now, they were arrested upon their return. And the FBI found through their social media postings that the Rise Above movement had participated in an MMA or mixed martial arts competition at the Reconquista Club in Kiev under the watch of the Azov Battalion. And for the first time, we see an arm of U.S. law enforcement refer to the Azov Battalion as a dangerous group that is actually training and radicalizing American white supremacists. And so that's why I called the piece Blowback. It's a classic case of blowback where a group that is, you know, a radical group that is serving as a frontline proxy of U.S. empire in the trench war against Russia or pro-Russian separatists is actually causing destabilization back in the U.S. by exporting its radicalism back to its sponsor. And so here we are. And of course, this story has been completely ignored and buried by the mainstream media.
That's the voice of Max Blumenthal. Max joins us from Washington, D.C. He is a journalist, a best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He's a filmmaker. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. We're talking about the fact that fascists in Ukraine, who, Max, are seem to be also not only integrated into Ukraine's pro-American National Guard, but also receiving and getting training in weapons provided by the Pentagon, they are training fascist, white supremacist, white nationalists, some of whom Donald Trump thinks are very fine people, amongst them at least. They're training them, and it is blowback. And, you know, there's always been blowback. The rise of fascism in the 1930s, it was not just in Italy. It wasn't just in Germany. It was, in fact, throughout all of continental Europe. If you look at the capitalist countries of Europe just prior to World War II, or say by June 1940, after the French upper classes quickly capitulated to the Nazi invasion, almost all of continental Europe was fascist or led by fascists. And they had a lot of American friends back, including in very high places, including, say, John Foster Dulles. If you go to Dulles Airport here in right outside of Washington, named after the Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and his brother, who was the head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, they were actually pretty sympathetic to Hitler, pretty sympathetic to the fascist project until Germany and America went to war. And then when the Maidan protests happened, and when the Azov Brigade and the right sector and these fascists overthrew the democratically elected, corrupt, but democratically elected government of Yanukovych in February 2014, you had liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans like John McCain and Hillary Clinton in the State Department. Well, she was gone by then. Spokespeople like Victoria Nuland, who had been Clinton's spokesperson, loving the protests in the Maidan, including and not differentiating, at least, from these fascists who were part of it. So this kind of sort of, I don't know if we want to call it blowback, but certainly the interconnectedness between American political elites and fascists, actually not something that new.
No, it's really consistent with the tradition of American hybrid warfare or unconventional warfare against Russia, where they, you know, go into these states on Russia's periphery and fund proxy movements who happen to be extremists, whether it's the Afghan Mujahideen or in, you know, the Russia-allied state of Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, and, you know, 31 flavors of Takfiri, or the Azov Battalion in Ukraine. You know, and there's a traditional relationship, as you mentioned, Brian, between Nazis in countries like Ukraine and the U.S. throughout the Cold War. After World War II, the U.S. Brought in, gave asylum to Nazi war criminals who had collaborated with the German military from Ukraine, like Miklos Lebed, and, you know, set up a newspaper for them through the CIA in New York called Prologue, and pumped out anti-communist propaganda while Reinhard Gehlen took over the German intelligence service. This is a figure who directed the Gestapo under the watch of the CIA. So you know, this is a traditional relationship, but it should be particularly disturbing now, given how much we're seeing a resurgence of anti-Semitic and white supremacist violence in the United States, that there is a group which has benefited from U.S. arms, and the U.S. is now granting $200 million in military support to Ukraine, that is actually training Nazis from around the world, welcoming them as foreign fighters, and allowing them to benefit from the lessons that they're gaining in the field as a frontline U.S. proxy against pro-Russian separatists. I mean, I think this is a really disturbing development, and we're hearing very little about it. And it's because, as you mentioned, Brian, you know, the project of the Maidan coup and bringing pro-EU, pro-NATO nationalists into government in Kiev is a bipartisan project in Washington. So, for example, when I saw Andrei Poruby, who is the founder of two neo-Nazi parties in Ukraine, the Social National Party, which is based on this National Socialist Party of Germany, and the Patriot of Ukraine militia. When I saw him appear on Capitol Hill, welcomed by Speaker Paul Ryan, because Parubi today is the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, he was welcomed by, you know, not just right-wing Republicans, but by Michael Carpenter, who is Joe Biden's handler on Ukraine and basically was the U.S. point man on supporting the Maidan coup. So this is a really inconvenient issue. The U.S. has invested a lot of resources into bleeding Russia in Ukraine. The Azov battalion's doing the frontline fighting. They're the best fighters. They're the most ideologically dedicated. And at the same time, they're causing a huge problem because they've established political parties. Their supporters are honeycombed throughout the Ukrainian government. And they're welcoming in not just American white supremacists, but far-right parties that are in governing coalitions in countries like Latvia. And they're building ties across national lines and actually embarking on a project to reconquer the European continent. And I got to say, you know, as fantastical as it sounds that there could be a fascist reconquest of Europe, the far right is doing extremely well across Europe. They have a lot of momentum and they are appearing at these conferences in Kiev from France, from the UK, and from across Eastern Europe and from Southern California.
You know, it seems they're becoming increasingly bold, too. And when you've got the president of the United States or the vice president of the United States retweeting tweets that come from some of these far right European leaders, it further emboldens them. You know, it's no accident that the third largest party in Greece, for example, is an avowed neo-Nazi party and a violent one at that. And it's gone through three election cycles now where it's the third largest party in the country and has a huge parliamentary presence.
And Richard Grenell, Trump's ambassador to Germany, said one of his goals in Germany is to work with and facilitate the political resurgence of right-wing parties in Europe. I mean, that's the actual ambassador from the United States to Germany. Go ahead, Max.
Yeah, and you have Steve Bannon taking a foray into Brazilian politics to help weaponize WhatsApp and various social media platforms to boost the hopes of Jair Bolsonaro, and it really worked. These are the kind of Cambridge Analytica tactics that Bannon honed during the 2016 election. Brazil actually has a long history of fascism itself, and the Azov Battalion has welcomed members of a neo-Nazi group, which is running rampant in Brazil, called the Misanthropic Division. So these ties are transatlantic. The Azov Battalion, through its international secretary, Olena Semeniaco, who is named in the FBI indictment, actually has a geopolitical or geostrategic plan for reconquering Europe that starts in the immediate periphery of Ukraine. It's called the Intermarium. The Intermarium was a concept first introduced after World War I by Joseph Pilsudski, who was the Polish military leader. And the idea was to form a regional bloc from the around the Black and Baltic Seas against German and Russian aggression, because you know the Polish saw that they were going to be attacked on both sides. The concept of this regional federation came to nothing. But after the Maidan coup in Ukraine, Ukrainians thought, NATO has failed to stop Russia from annexing Crimea. We're defenseless. We need to form a bond with our neighbors here against Russia. And so the Intermarium concept was revived. And one of the key figures to take it on and to really promote it is Andrzej Duda, who is the president of Poland, a very right-wing president who recently presided over an Independence Day march that saw something like 10,000 open fascists and white supremacists demonstrate alongside the legitimate parade. You know, he favors this kind of regional anti-Russian bloc, which overlaps and reinforces and expands NATO. But then you have Semeniaco, the neo-Nazi ideologue from Azov, and she's hosting a series of Intermarium conferences in Eastern Europe that are actually getting official support. And their idea is that the Intermarium is not just a security bloc against Russia, but it's a base for expanding white supremacist ideology across Europe into Western Europe. And so, for example, the Latvian National Front Party, which is a member of the Latvian governing coalition, has sponsored an official event at its embassy in Kiev welcoming a who's who of neo-Nazi figures from Kiev to discuss the Intermarium. And this really provides the neo-Nazis of Azov with a Trojan horse into NATO, because Latvia is a NATO country. That's the danger, and it's a very serious one.
Max Blumenthal is our guest. Max, we had John McCain actually in the Maidan, in that part of Kiev, meeting with these peoples, taking pictures with them, and wishing them well. And then when the armed coup d'etat happened, which was February 22nd, 2014, McCain and the U.S. State Department then under Barack Obama, in other words, Democrats and Republicans, called it, I think I'm paraphrasing, but sort of like a new day for Ukraine, like something wonderful had happened. Now, many of the people in those protests could have just been Western-oriented, Western Ukrainians who didn't like Yanukovych, who wanted to take Ukraine and integrate it more into the West rather than to Russia. They may not have been fascists, but it really were fascist militias that carried out the coup that led to this great new day for Ukraine, as McCain put it. And then even though maybe the liberal Democrats don't have the same affinity with fascists, they do seem to have the same affinity with John McCain. Like when he died, Elizabeth Warren said, Democrat or Republican, foreign leader or president of the United States, John McCain would go toe-to-toe with anyone to fight for what he thought was right. Well, in Maidan, he was fighting with or alongside these same Nazis or neo-Nazis. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it's not an exaggeration to call them Nazis. I mean, John McCain was standing on stage with a popular Ukrainian politician named Oleh Tyanbakh, who is a co-founder of the Social National Party I mentioned, and has been photographed sig-heiling, delivering the Nazi Roman salute. And, you know, a lot of people forget that also on stage in front of the Maidan, alongside this sig-heiling Nazi figure and John McCain, was Chris Murphy, the liberal Democratic senator from Connecticut. So this is indeed a bipartisan project that the monster was let out of the box under the watch of Barack Obama, with Victoria Nuland as Assistant Secretary of State handing out cookies to protesters in the Maidan. Now, the protesters in the Maidan, you know, they're not, by and large, they weren't Nazis. A lot of them were kind of liberal reformist types who wanted to get closer to the EU, classic kind of color revolution model. But you know, the street muscle who did battle with the state riot police was Right Sector, which is a collection of neo-Nazi ideologues and football ultras. And, you know, they worked alongside the Patriot of Ukraine militia to form the Azov Battalion in 2014 when war erupted in the Donbass region against pro-Russian separatists. So we're 4 years down the road. Basically, the liberal reformist elements in Ukraine are under attack from the neo-Nazis who they celebrated and who helped allow them to fulfill what they called their revolution of dignity. And you've seen over 50 attacks on activists this year, mostly pro-Maidan activists. One pro-Maidan anti-corruption crusader had acid thrown in her face by neo-Nazis and died months later. Yesterday, we saw a trans rights march in Kiev, about a dozen people trying to demonstrate for the rights of trans people. And they were set upon by Nazis, including the state-funded, state-sponsored C-14 militia, and were brutalized while police just stood there and did nothing, because the police are heavily penetrated by neo-Nazis. Meanwhile, you have Petro Poroshenko, who's this hopelessly corrupt figure who's a Western puppet, who is the president. And Poroshenko understands that he cannot go against the agenda of the neo-Nazi forces. They've brought out 10,000 people in Kiev and threatened a coup if he violated their agenda. But beyond that, the West is in a crisis because Ukraine has become an economic basket case that's overrun with corruption. So through the Atlantic Council, the kind of NATO-backed think tank in Washington that formulates a lot of our policy these days on Ukraine, you know, the supporters of the Maidan and the handlers of the Ukraine in the Trump administration came up with an idea of an anti-corruption committee that they would impose on Poroshenko's government. And if he would crack down on corruption, then they would authorize more aid. And so they made the aid contingent on kind of cleaning up his act. And so he established this commission. The Atlantic Council had a bunch of seminars celebrating it on Capitol Hill. It was being cheered for by John McCain's office. And who gets put in charge of the Anti-Corruption Commission? the leader of the neo-Nazi C-14 militia is in charge of the Anti-Corruption Commission in Ukraine. So what does the 14 and C-14 stand for? It stands for the 14 words conceived by American white supremacist convicted terrorist David Lane, who is the leader of the order. And, you know, the 14 words are, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. So that's who's in charge of the Anti-Corruption Commission that Washington demanded in Ukraine. It really says it all. And, you know, what needs to happen? Congress has cut off arms, you know, at least officially, in the defense appropriation bill to the Azov Battalion on the basis of its white supremacist ideology. The arms are still going to find their way into the Azov militia. And we've learned that Israel and Israeli weapons are being supplied in place of U.S. weapons. But what needs to happen is U.S. law enforcement needs to start paying attention to the fact that Americans, including veterans of American wars, are going to fight with Azov, and white supremacists are going to participate in these conferences in Kiev, and they should be treated the same way that ISIS foreign fighters who return to the U.S. are, and they should be prosecuted. This should be illegal, and we should ask, why hasn't that happened yet? Well, it's very clear. The U.S. continues to encourage the Azov Battalion as a frontline proxy in its cynical imperial trench war in the east of Ukraine.
Indeed. Max Blumenthal is our guest. We have 2 minutes left. And if for our audience, just to remember, it was following the coup in Ukraine led by these neo-Nazis that the rebellion started in the eastern part of Ukraine, the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine, and also when the Russian government supported the referendum in Crimea, whereby people in Crimea, Russian-speaking people, voted in overwhelming numbers to reintegrate Crimea into Russia, which, of course, is the point at which U.S. relations went to absolutely into the basement and started in earnest the new Cold War. All of these issues are profoundly interconnected. The blowback also for Americans is, as U.S.-Russian antagonism grows, as the U.S. continues to support these right-wing forces in Ukraine, also, the danger of real major power conflict arises, and it's not something we should assume is just, you know, words on a page. These are real, real dangers. 1.5 minutes left. Go ahead, Max.
Well, you know, when you get into a great power conflict where the armies can't confront one another in a conventional way, what takes place is proxy warfare or hybrid warfare, which is a hybrid of information war and unconventional war and kind of color revolutions, these manufactured protests. And the U.S. has traditionally, in great power conflicts during the Cold War, as I mentioned, relied on extremist proxies in a very cynical way. And then once the U.S. is done with these proxies, whether it's the Afghan Mujahideen, the, you know, Cuban exiles who staged the Bay of Pigs, or, you know, Syrian jihadist extremists, they have a disposal problem. They don't know what to do with them. And they have to give them something to do, or they will just simply roam around and cause destabilization back on the home front. And that's what we're starting to see take place with the Azov Battalion, as they have gained influence that was first completely denied by the supporters of the Ukraine. And it's gone well beyond anyone's wildest imagination to the point where they've created a state within a state in Ukraine, and they're beginning to export their white supremacist revolution abroad. So, you know, we're going to continue to see more blowback from this cynical relationship with Ukraine and from the kind of proxy wars we're fighting. And as the U.S. deepens its conflict with China, I think, you know, that kind of problematic relationship with proxies will just expand to new areas around the globe. And this is something we have to be aware of back home.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That's Max Blumenthal. His article is entitled Blowback, an Inside Look at How U.S.-Funded Fascists in Ukraine Mentor White Supremacists. Max Blumenthal is a journalist, best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garofa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web designer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
Good to be back. I missed you all last week.
Yes. Yes, you did. But we're back. And Chris, there's a lot to talk about, of course, but let's start with the Facebook New York Times story. It was actually an odd story. It was a major story. Then there were derivative stories. And you could kind of feel as the week wore on in the days after the original story that there was a lot of jockeying probably within the editorial group within the New York Times and perhaps with commentary back and forth from Facebook. Who knows? The story kind of kept getting tweaked. But let's go over the big picture. Help us understand what this article showed about Facebook.
Yeah, this story, ever since it broke last week, has not gone away. We're just under a week since the New York Times published this last Wednesday, and it is growing and, as you said, spawning all these offshoots. It starts out saying that Sheryl Sandberg was seething. That's some nice alliteration there. But what this article really comes out to is showing that Facebook was in crisis mode and has been for some time. They have set up war rooms to prepare Sheryl Sandberg, to prepare Mark Zuckerberg and others for talking to Congress, for talking to the press. But it shows that they failed to reveal to Congress some of the things that were happening internally, the things that they were aware of about information mismanagement and just complete breaches of privacy internally that some staff, including a former technology officer, Alex Stamos, had brought to them. And this article, you know, it says, don't poke the bear, right? It shows how Congress was actually trying, or certain Congress members were trying to get the rest of Congress to back off. In particular, and it's so important to repeat this, Chuck Schumer, a leader in the Democratic Party, had told other Democratic Party members to not investigate Facebook, just, you know, stop questioning them so hard. That's important because Chuck Schumer's daughter actually works for Facebook in New York.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, geez.
But there's another side to the story, too, which is, I mean, there's so many different elements of it, and I want to go through it. But part of it was, as the anti-Russia witch hunt gathered steam in Congress, at first, Zuckerberg and Facebook were saying, look, what the Russians did, if they did anything, through this internet research agency, the IRA, a troll farm in St. Petersburg, it was so minuscule that it didn't really have any impact on the election. And then Congress started attacking Facebook because they weren't, you know, functioning as an echo chamber for the Russia probe. They weren't doing their part. And then Facebook started to come back, it seemed to me, to bend to this pressure from the Democrats, not Schumer necessarily, but from others, and to say, yeah, it really was bad what the Russians were doing. And then they started to offer evidence, and the evidence was that this troll farm had paid for $100,000 or so of Facebook ads, 56% of which turned out to be ads after the election.
Yep.
None of which mentioned any particular candidate about all kinds of issues. And then Zuckerberg said, well, we didn't fully appreciate the danger. But it seemed to me that they were just now bending in the other direction under pressure, the political pressure about Russiagate. And then they started to exaggerate the number of people who could have potentially been reached by this $100,000 Facebook ad campaign by the IRA. Not to mention now, let's remember, Trump spent about $90 million, not $100,000, $90 million with a very sophisticated social media campaign and a very sophisticated Facebook campaign.
That's right.
Much more so than Hillary Clinton. The Clinton campaign focused on television ads. The Trump campaign was tweaking Facebook because a lot of people get their news from Facebook, and they were targeting audiences with very targeted messages. So, Chris, it seemed to me that, I mean, there's different parts of the story, but part of the story is that as Facebook started to go badly with Congress because they weren't doing their part in terms of the witch hunt.
That's right. You know, I feel like Facebook at first, when all of this started coming out, Facebook at first was trying to do it, you know, save itself in the PR, you know, in PR mode by saying, no one's using our platform for this. It's not possible to say that, you know, to separate Facebook from these accusations. But when they got enough pressure, when it was clear that this was this was the narrative that was going to be put forward. They completely fell in line. And Mark Zuckerberg has posted, you know, so many times about how Facebook is supposed to be this safe platform and all of that. You know, I just looked it up. Donald Trump has 23 million followers or likes on Facebook, right? And some of the vitriolic things he's posting, even just this morning about supposed illegal immigrants, you know, have significant reach, much more than any of the supposed IRA posts, which you're right. Only a couple of them even mentioned political candidates. One of them was Jill Stein, and that ad was after the election and got almost no interaction. But Facebook has now also gone and they're saying Iran is now part of the problem. So in coordinated efforts with Twitter, Facebook is now taking down accounts that it says are related to not just Russia, but Iran as well. And again, these pages, these individual accounts and these groups have such minuscule reach when you compare them to the U.S. mass media, to Donald Trump's own pages, that it's laughable to think that they had any impact on U.S. politics or the election in 2016 or in 2018. What Facebook is doing, though, is targeting, and as we've talked about before, targeting left-wing pages, targeting alternative news pages on the left and a few on the right, and taking those down as well. But they're getting caught up in these huge sweeps. So what's covered is that it's Russian bots or Russian pages, but ultimately it's actually alternative media and progressive pages that are, you know, that are getting the biggest, being impacted the most here.
Yeah, I'm looking also at a story on NBC News, and it's also another part to this story. Facebook hired firm with in-house fake news shop, that's in quotes, to combat the public relations crisis. Facebook ties to Definers Public Affairs, first reported on Wednesday in the New York Times, sparked widespread criticism and accusations of hypocrisy. And I want to read a couple sentences, Chris, and then get you to respond. The conservative lobbying firm that Facebook hired in the midst of an October 2017 public relations crisis about Russian disinformation included what one former employee told NBC News was, quote, an in-house fake news shop, close quote, as part of its operations. Facebook's ties to the lobbying firm, Definers Public Affairs, was first reported on Wednesday in the Times, which detailed how the group aimed to, quote, discredit activist protesters of Facebook, in part by linking them to liberal financier George Soros, who has become the subject of widespread right-wing conspiracy theories for his philanthropy work. What is the Definers Public Affairs?
Yeah, so they are a right-wing PR firm. They actually have been founded by, you know, longtime Republican Party operatives. One of their main players is actually the former spokesperson for Jeb Bush, if anyone remembers him. It's certainly a right wing operation. Now, this is important because a lot is made out about how Sheryl Sandberg is a Democrat and Mark Zuckerberg is a Democrat. And there's all this, you know, frequently there's talk about a Zuckerberg 2020 presidential run, which is a terrifying idea in and of itself, but not completely out of the realm of possibility these days, apparently. But it doesn't matter that they are, you know, they're Democrats, they're supposed, you know, liberals and all of that, right? The entire system works to defend itself, whether or not it's Republican or Democrat. And so I'm sure that Zuckerberg and Sandberg and so many others see no issue and no dissonance here working with this conservative outlet.
Chris, I want to ask you, too, about this statement that Zuckerberg made that Facebook is at war and that he's going to run the company like a general running an army. What do you make of this? Is this just hyperbole or is he going to make something even bigger of this? Are we going to have to worry now about Facebook fighting us?
Yeah, I think we've always had to worry about Facebook fighting us. We have known for a long time that Facebook is working very closely with the national security state, with state intelligence apparatus, but it also works very closely with advertisers to influence our perception and what we see. It works very closely now with news publishers. It works closely with the Atlantic Council to influence what is allowed on Facebook and what is not, to not just remove pages outright, but promote or demote them in their newsfeed algorithm. So yes, Zuckerberg, as part of the, as an extension of the state, effectively, as still as the owner of a private corporation, is at war with, I think we can say, with the truth, to go with the theme of this show. This is information warfare, John, and it absolutely is going to be a very important thing for people to pay really close attention to the language that Zuckerberg and others are using in this. The fact that they say that it's war tells us how they view their users and effectively the people that make their platform possible.
So what does a shareholder do? What can a shareholder do? Is there anything?
I mean, the shareholders effectively are going to sit there and continue to make their profit, because as long as Facebook is still in, you know, the good graces of the government, they're going to continue to get, you know, investment. They're going to get, you know, good deals on whenever they want to open up a new office, as we're seeing with Amazon right now. I wouldn't say that the shareholders are going to be the ones that change this. I would actually look to Facebook's employees to be the ones to address this and to change this, just like we've seen recently with Amazon, Google, Salesforce, and many others.
Right. Well, Chris, let's switch over to another story. There was a very interesting and I believe important story in the Wall Street Journal about facial recognition technology. Facial recognition is going mainstream, and civil libertarians are saying that this is a bad and dangerous development. I believe it's a bad and dangerous development just because of privacy issues. One of the quotes in here is from a senior associate at Georgetown University's Law Center on Privacy and Technology, who says that most American adults are already in a face recognition database accessible to law enforcement. How is that possible? Who holds that database? Who controls it?
That's held actually by many private companies. Let's put it this way. If there has ever been a photo of you on Facebook, you are in Facebook's facial recognition database. But there are also companies that aren't nearly as public and that we wouldn't even think of that are holding this information. And we should talk about, too, this goes further than facial recognition. But there are cameras effectively everywhere. These cameras are collecting massive, massive amounts of information, you know, terabytes of streaming data constantly. Most of these cameras are operated by private security firms. They're operated by, you know, private agencies. And now, we should also talk about a related story coming out of QZ, that the DEA and ICE are actually hiding surveillance cameras in streetlights now. So next time you pass a surveillance camera, and this is something that's being started out in Texas, the company is actually called Cowboy Streetlight Concealments, and they're based out of Houston, Texas. And so this is coming out of the Wall Street Journal. This is coming out of Quartz or QZ.com. This growing trend that we're seeing of facial recognition and facial analysis, and this is something that Amazon has also played a role in, right? So this company in Texas can get this information, right? They can do facial recognition in the camera, but then the DEA and ICE can still take all that video, upload it to Amazon's recognition software, which they've been doing, and then do more facial analysis to identify people.
Yeah, right. And the British have been doing this for many years. I think the British are the most surveilled people in the world. At least that's what the media says. There are cameras literally everywhere. They have these massive databases, and they say it's for the public safety, it's anti-terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. But you literally can't walk 10 feet in the UK without multiple cameras picking up your movements. Is that where we're headed here in the US?
I believe that is where we're headed, unless we have a movement to oppose it. We should also mention Singapore. Singapore actually is the second most surveilled place in the world. There are cameras, and much of the surveillance technology is actually developed for the British government, but also the government of Singapore. And it's almost as bad as the level of Britain. And that is very rarely ever talked about.
You can't chew gum in Singapore either.
No, it's banned. You're going to get caned for that.
They're going to watch you. Yeah, it's a police state in Singapore.
It is. It's a police state.
It's a very modernistic police state.
Yeah, and very friendly.
And friendly, unless you're... There was a guy who was actually caned,
guy from Ohio.
He was chewing gum, right?
He was chewing gum.
Yes.
I think he spat it out on the sidewalk as well.
Oh, well, see, that's the thing. Like, when you walked out, I was in Singapore for the Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump summit. I had never been there. It's pristine. It's not a city with a garden, but it's a garden with a city. So it's a very planned city. And it's very pristine, very pretty, at least on a superficial level. But yeah, they have complete control. There's only one spot in Singapore where a demonstration is allowed. And you have to go to this particular like little tiny square if you want to speak up and speak out. And then there's obvious things that you have to do to get permission to be in this one little tiny spot. So yeah, it's a small, carefully controlled, basically, it's a police state.
It sure is. And as so happens now, it's also heavily surveilled and making good use of this facial recognition software.
On the upside about Singapore, they have amazing public housing.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
The majority of the public actually lives in public housing, and it's affordable, and it's well-constructed. It's good. It makes public housing seem like the thing that you want to do.
Well, if I ever get to Singapore, I will check out the housing. I will avoid chewing gum.
We digressed there a little. We digressed a little bit from some of the technology issues, but
I do want to raise something actually very related to this to facial recognition is voice recognition and accent recognition. So there's a story from The Intercept over the past week about how Amazon, who's doing facial recognition, is also doing accent recognition technology that what The Intercept says is could tell the government where you're from. And this really struck me because I had seen this article last week. And then over the weekend, I had to call a couple of my credit card companies just to try to negotiate some better rates. And a few of them actually said on their automated lines that your voice may be used to authenticate you. So they have recordings of your voice and they're analyzing that. And then when you're talking and to the agent, they're going to use that recording and that analysis of your voice to determine whether it's actually you saying that you're you. So again, just like facial recognition, this is now, you know, consider your voice print to be like a fingerprint or your face pattern. This is now a private company storing more data about you and information about you in ways that, you know, we would never even expect to have. And Amazon, of course, is working on accent recognition technology and I'm sure other things to learn more about you from your voice. I'm sure no one's ever thought about voice recognition technology being used for that, right? Except some Amazon patent attorney.
You know, yesterday I bought my son a phone, a new iPhone 10XR or something. I don't know what it is. And it has this facial recognition thing. You don't have to do a thumbprint anymore. And I said to him, what happens if I take your phone and I just hold it up to your face while you're sleeping? Can I hack into your phone that way? He said, I don't think so. I think there has to be some kind of a safety measure. So I tried it last night. And the phone opened right
like
up.
You sound like an intelligence officer.
I was kind of curious. And the phone opened right up. And I'm wondering if the same thing could be done with this voice recognition technology where they can sort of fabricate your voice. If they've got examples of your voice saved, you know, on a chip somewhere, could they use those samples of your voice to, you know, invade your privacy in some way?
Yeah, they certainly could. There's actually a whole industry of something called deep fakes. And if they have enough of your voice, you know, enough recordings of your voice saying different things and enough visuals of your face while you're speaking, they can actually make a video that looks and sounds like you talking, but saying whatever it is they want. And there are some, if you go on YouTube, there are actually some examples. People have done this with Obama saying, you know, very ridiculous things that he clearly didn't say. You know, some of them are funny, some of them are terrifying, but this is actually something that is being done. And so what happens if, you know, Chase, who, you know, stores this information on me apparently, gets hacked and this information gets out? Our information is being used in all of these very terrifying ways.
So they can Photoshop your voice, in essence?
That's a really good way to put it, actually. Yeah, Photoshopping your voice and putting it on something else and overlaying it, you know.
They have, let's say, John or my voice or your voice, Chris, and they can just make up other words with the same. In other words, people, they can put words in your mouth through the Photoshopping your voice. Is that what we're talking about?
That is literally what we're talking about. And then also Photoshopping your face. So it looks like you are saying the words that you're hearing.
Yeah. So I could say, people could see me saying, I hate the show Loud and Clear with Brian Becker.
And I voted for Donald Trump.
I voted for Donald. Yeah, exactly. In other words, that's all doable right now.
That is doable. It's not easily doable at this point. You need a lot of recordings. You need a lot of video, which is why Barack Obama was one of the first examples of this, because there's so much recording, so much video, and he came to be president in the era of high-def television. So that's why he's been, you know, one of the focuses of this. But it won't be long until we're seeing it for Donald Trump and so many others, because all of our phones now, to John's point, are recording in HD video.
That's true. It's HD video. It's something like 12 megapixels now is standard across the cell phone industry. It's crystal clear. It's like having 5G on your film. It's ridiculous.
Wow. Okay, I'm behind the news, guys. You know, we sometimes our guests say, you know, whenever I'm on, people say, wow, that was really depressing about your show, like especially our nuclear show on Wednesday. But I'm depressed now even about our own show in real time.
Yeah, this is actually frightening, seriously.
Anyway, we need a new system, everybody, and it has to be soon. We have to save the environment because we have 12 years, according to the UN. Yep. And this technology is moving so exponentially that in the hands of bad actors, meaning most state forces and certainly corporate entities, it's an enormous power. It's a power that states and corporate entities did not enjoy in the past. They had other ways of exercising power, but this is something new. And that's why it's important that we're doing this segment where we talk about technology issues, not just simply bouncing off the news, but trying to establish a perspective on technology rather than letting the technology drive the discussion. Chris Garofa, let's go on to the next story.
Okay, so staying on the topic of Amazon, Amazon has been ordered in court to give Alexa evidence in a New Hampshire double murder case. So there's a man who was charged with killing two women and an awful murder in January 2017. The judge in the case has ordered Amazon to hand over any captured audio on this Amazon Echo device. So the Amazon Echo, it's that cylinder that Amazon sells where you can say, hey, you know, buy me some butter and have it delivered, you know, to my house or whatnot, or play, you know, this radio station or this song. These things are almost always recording. They're not supposed to keep that recording for too long, but it's been shown in the past that Amazon actually does store the recordings for longer than it should be. So now this judge is telling Amazon, and Amazon has already said it is going to comply with this, that it needs to hand over the recordings, any recordings it has, and any other data about searches or any voice commands from this specific device, from this customer. This isn't the first time that it's happened, but when it happened in the past, Amazon didn't actually end up having to comply because the case was not continued to trial. It was settled before trial. So this is the first time that Amazon has agreed to and actually will hand over this information. So this is something we have to consider, right, as we're talking. We are giving all of our information, our voice, our face, our fingerprints, our emotions and information over to these private companies without them being honest and transparent about what they're doing with it and how it's going to be used. We need that transparency. We need those guarantees. But so long as, first, there's a profit motive, and second, these companies rely on the government as much as the government relies on them, we are not going to get that. And that's why we need independent movements. That's why we need movements to protect, as we always say, the Fourth Amendment, but also to expand our privacy rights and to guarantee those privacy rights.
Chris Garofa, let's go on to another story. The U.S. military is testing stratospheric balloons that ride the wind so they never have to come down. What is this story?
Yeah, so this is something that the military and actually DARPA, which is one of the advanced, you know, research agencies of the military, it has been working on for a very long time. The interesting thing about this is coming from the MIT Technology Review. It says a sensor that can spot the wind direction from miles away will let DARPA's surveillance balloons hover at the very edge of space in one spot indefinitely. This is going to be significantly less expensive for DARPA, for the military, than putting a full-fledged satellite out into space in geosynchronous orbit or just in a stationary orbit around the planet. So this is technology that could be used, right? This could be used for good. This could be used for weather forecasting and weather monitoring, but it's going to be used for DARPA and U.S. military surveillance. And, you know, let's also mention Google is getting in on this game as well. Google has a moonshot agency, right? That basically, you know, does all of these, you know, huge forward-looking things, it says, is also working on these sorts of balloons. I don't know which one is scarier, the fact that the military could be spying on us through these balloons or that Google could. But this is something that it's a newer technology that is close to being perfected, apparently. And these could be launching within the next 5 to 8 years.
I can tell you, too, as a former intelligence community officer, that DARPA is probably the darkest of all of the Pentagon bureaus or offices, in that it's DARPA that's trying to develop, that's experimenting with these futuristic technologies. It's DARPA that's developing, for example, a sound weapon where you can just beam sounds at your enemy and, you know, make his head explode practically without actually firing a shot. So when you read something like this about this lighter than air balloon being tested and it's hovering on the edge of space and it's, you know, it's for communications. Maybe it's not for communications. Maybe it's for weapons or surveillance and spying, whatever. Take this seriously, because DARPA, remember, DARPA belongs to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon's job is to fight wars. And so we should assume that this technology will eventually be used for war.
And war always, in the technologies of war, as we could see just in the last 20 years, migrate back to the home front, even
always,
if they didn't start at the home front, like the militarization of police with Iraq military equipment.
You know what? As an aside, you know the Roomba, that machine that just vacuums your floor while you're not home? That was invented at the CIA. On my very first day in the CIA, I saw that thing moving around and I asked what it was. And they said, oh, in the Directorate of Science and Technology, they just invented this thing. We're experimenting with it and see what we could do with it. As it turned out, it was just a vacuum cleaner. But that technology always comes back into the mainstream.
Chris Garaffa, we always end our show with you on technology, which is every Monday, with a technology tip. What is it this week?
Well, Brian, you mentioned earlier we have 12 years before climate change crosses this catastrophic line. You know, people may not realize, but computers can be recycled and so can phones. And people should do that. It's not going to save the planet, but it's always a good thing to do, to recycle rather than throw them out. But before you do that, before you toss your phone or computer into your local city's electronics recycling, you need to make sure that all of your information is off that device. Because then anyone can go in, pick up your device, and look through the hard drive and get, you know, maybe your credit card information, your private messages. So the way to do that is just, you're going to want to go into your system settings and choose a hard reset on your phone. It's going to say erase all content. On a computer, you're going to go into your computer management area and you're going to say do a secure erase. And it'll take some time, because what it's doing is it's actually writing random information onto your system so that even the DoD isn't able to get that information back off of your hard drive. It's actually the same security that the DoD publicly uses when it erases its own equipment and makes it impossible to get that off. So recycle your stuff, but make sure that before you get rid of it, you have securely gotten rid of any of your personal information so that somebody can't just get it and impersonate you or get your credit card information or see what you've been browsing on the internet.
That's this week's technology tip from Chris Garaffa. Chris joins us every week at this time from New Haven, Connecticut. He is a web developer and technologist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.